Swami Kriyananda, in a conversation, a satsang that I attended in India with him some years ago, he made a very simple comment. He said, it's very difficult to understand because this world seems so complicated. Here we are all sitting here. Each of us has have come together in this moment to share this experience, but all of us have these universes that go out from this place. Our families, our jobs, our responsibilities, our personal worries, our history, all the different things. Every one of us is this whirlpool of other realities, and like circles, we find a point where we intersect, but apparently none of us are complete copies of one another. And this is one tiny little fragment of this universe. You go to another gathering place, whether it's the sports bar where they're watching whatever they're watching right now, or all the other churches and temples that have gatherings, and the soccer players, and this is just El Camino Real. You know, you can go someplace else. I don't have to explain it to you. It just goes on and on, countries and cultures. And last night, here we had the fourth of the four performances of our children's play, our theater production from our Living Wisdom School, 70 children in costumes, their parents, their uncles, their aunts, their grandparents. After it was all over, Gary McSweeney and I were two of the last people to leave, and everyone was gone, virtually. Just a couple of people were left. All the children were gone. And it was like the building itself was saying, ah, peace at last. There had been such an intensity of energy. And there you're watching not even people who are full adults in command of their lives, but people who are very much just at the beginning of their incarnations, who are being born for a world that many of us will never see. We don't know what destiny is contained within those little vehicles at this point. So all of this, as Swamiji was saying, causes us to think, now if I'm going to think about divinity, if I'm going to talk about the infinite power and the one who made it all, it's going to be all of this complexity just multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. And it's almost like huff puff, we can hardly stand it. And thus philosophy is born, and philosophy of religion, and philosophy of reality. And when I did my 1 year of college, which was pretty much all I could handle, I was over at Stanford University. I was looking for a guru. And I was looking for truth and wisdom, and I didn't yet understand where I would actually find it. So, being raised in this culture, I thought a fine university would be a natural place to find it. And I took a class, because this was like 1966, 67, I took a class called Consciousness. And so I went into this class thinking that somebody was going to help me with my consciousness. That was my intention. And instead, I found myself in endless, long discussions about the concept of consciousness. And this person would guess, and that person would guess, and then all of us, as egalitarian, arrogant, smart Stanford students, would guess, and everybody would just sort of spend time guessing. And I went to a couple of classes and then stopped going. I wasn't interested in guessing. I was interested in understanding. And above all, I was interested in happiness. It seemed pretty self-evident to me that the point of what we were doing was not to suffer. And I couldn't even like get that idea going, except as one more opinion that we would then discuss. What is suffering? Who wants to suffer? I know what suffering is. What kind of a conversation is this? You know? And what was so annoying is that they all knew what suffering was too, but there we were in this atmosphere where complexity itself was considered to be wise, which is a natural, you know, derivative idea from what we see. But Swamiji was trying to change that completely, speaking of the central point of reality being one of silence and unity. I mean, the concept of one is not really very complicated, is it? Just one. You have one. There it is. You have unity. There it is. And you have stillness. There it is. There's no big story around any of that. And what we don't understand is that even though from the heart of all of this, this enormous complexity has expressed itself, the closer you get to the origin point, the more utterly simple it becomes. And Swamiji made that statement at this satsang that I was sitting in. The next morning he said, I don't think most people realized how important that idea was. And it had intrigued me at the time, but of course his pointing to it again caused me to think about it a great deal both then and since. That what we're really doing spiritually is not becoming just a bigger and bigger repository of endless opinions and everybody else's long dissertations about other people's opinions. What we really are is we're getting back to the point of origin where it all resolves into utter simplicity. If we think even in very practical terms about our own lives and all the different things that we seek, when we really think about it, there's really just a few desires, however complexly we clothe them. We want to feel loved. We want to feel worthwhile. We want to find meaning in our experience. Above all, we don't want to suffer, and we do want to be happy. And you can trace whatever your trajectory of life is, however profound it is. Even our little tiny children, in fact, in many ways, it's much clearer with them because they're just acting the way they act according to what they think will work. When I was 7 years old, my parents sent me to sleepaway camp. And my brother and I went, and it was great fun. I was was one of the youngest children in the camp, and what I remember mostly is everybody really liked me, and they all took care of me. I can see now, taking care of small children, how little children are really cute, and I think I was pretty cute. But I was just a little young for what was going on, and one of the craft projects was to weave potholders out of elastic bands. It was just, you know, you have this little loom, and it was beyond my little fingers to just figure out how to make that thing work. So when Parents' Day came, everybody had potholders, but I didn't have any potholders because I'd been unable to make them. And nobody seemed to understand how deeply embarrassed I was not to have potholders, apparently. And everybody had their potholders hung on their bunks. And I remember this girl above me had quite a few, so I just took some of hers and hung them on my bunk, which at the time seemed like a good idea. Naturally, when she saw what I had done, she did not think it was a good idea, and she became quite upset about it, and there was a little bit of conflict resolution in our bunk there. But the part I remember the most about it was just, and then I tried to defend myself. I kept saying, they fell. I was not trained to lie. I'm surprised that I lied. But I kept saying, they fell, they fell. And I remember profoundly just how important it was to me, you know, to be like everyone else, to be able to do what other people were able to do, and not have to admit that it had been beyond me to handle that. 7 years old. Like, how different are we? 47, 57, 90? You know, we just want to be perceived as a certain reality. And we're always in this state of tension. I was just reflecting the other night, just as I was falling asleep, you know, when the subconscious mind starts asserting itself and the conscious mind doesn't have quite as much control. You know, and there was just this sort of what I would call low-level anxiety. And then it began to take really horrific kinds of forms, you know, imprisonment, torture, losing everything, becoming ill. It's just like, it's not a pleasant way to fall asleep at all. That's why it's very good to meditate before you go to sleep or to fall asleep listening to uplifting music. But mostly to me, it was extremely interesting. Just like, how many levels do we have in us of where we have separated ourselves out from our source, and because we are no longer deeply connected to source, we live out there in this world of opinion, where there's no safe ground to stand on that says, this is who I am, this is what I am, and in this reality I am safe. I'm also, to finish the story about the potholders, I remember the two parts of it. One was trying to tell people that they fell, and the other part was how wonderfully my mother responded to me. Because somehow she knew, as mothers can know, and she just took me on her lap, and I was weeping, and she was just stroking my hair. It's fine, dear. It's just fine. We don't need potholders, you know. But of such little moments, you know, was this experience of my feeling that my reality was dependent on something outside, and this wonderful woman who was my mother just telling me, no, dear, it's fine. We'll just take you just as you are. You can come home without potholders. It won't make any difference to us. Now, everything that happens in this world, and somehow children are clearer symbols sometimes than adults, is a divine story. And oddly enough, even though we think that this story is the real point of the drama, this is really the play. This is the director having sent us out and made us do our part. And our part is to find out, who am I really? Where does my happiness come from? Are those vague undercurrents of anxiety really a delusion, or are they reality? Is it that? How do I solve that? Where do I find where I really belong? And all of the scriptures and all of the masters, no matter how much people later garble those simple messages, the messages are all exactly the same. That we come from spirit. And this whole experience we have of this deep commitment to these limited realities and all the suffering that comes with it is really just a profound misunderstanding on our own part. I was at that camp. Everybody knew I was 7. If I had just been able to turn to one person and say, I can't do this. My little fingers are too small. Give me something else to do. Or if at the time when I was there in my bunk without any potholders, I could have said, oh, Mommy, look at all the great potholders everybody else made, and I just couldn't do it because I'm too small. How simple that would have been, wouldn't it? But who knows where and why all of these different forces come. Wasn't this year, but the year before, and when I was helping with this school play, and I accidentally found myself alone with about 15 little children before the play started. Position I have begged the faculty never to put me in again. And the children were, let's just say, excited. And they were doing things that were a little disturbing to me, running, you know, just being a little mad. And I had no training in education for life, and so I didn't really know how to master them, and I didn't really have deep relationships with them. So I turned to one little child, and I was so exasperated. I said, stop being so childish. And being a wise child, he gathered himself up, and he looked at me like this. And he just, in a very simple tone of voice, he said, but I am a child. And then at that point, I decided just if the faculty was foolish enough to leave me alone with them, they could take the consequences. And I just let the room go at that point, because I knew I had no hope. But it was such a simple answer, but I am a child. And we live our lives in this world always in this state of tension, not being able and willing to say so simply to our Heavenly Father and to our Divine Mother with that simple confidence, oh yeah, it's true, look, I got myself so embroiled in what? Sex, money, drugs, human relationships, what's happening? Okay? Yeah, everything depends on sound. I got myself so embroiled in whatever it is that I got embroiled in. I wanted to be famous. I wanted to be rich. I wanted to have that beautiful woman for my wife or that handsome man as my husband. I wanted my children, you know, to do honor to my name and, you know, all the different things that we desire and that we rarely get. And then we're all tense about everything. And we don't know how to just say so simply, but I am a child. Divine Mother, I had these ideas, and they looked like good ideas to me at the time. But inasmuch as I'm just a child, sometimes it doesn't work out in exactly the way that I hoped. One of our little children, one of the youngest, she's maybe 4.5 or 5 years old, she was in our play last night, and every time she would come on stage, she didn't really have the concept of creating the reality here. So she would just walk out and place herself about here and then just, you know, just sort of look out at everything. The children are so unconscious. The little boys had these big full black trousers on. And one of the performances, one of the little four-year-olds, five-year-olds, just grabbed the bottom of his pant legs, which are long enough, full enough, for him to pull all the way up to here. Then he turned his back, you know, and just had his little legs, and everybody else is facing the audience. And he found what was going on this way so interesting that he just stood there with his pants held up like this, you know, for a period of time, just sort of doing what seemed to make sense to him, you know, in that moment. And so we come out into this world and we do what seems to make sense to us. And most of the world seems to support that. That's where the trick comes in. Ever and again through your awakened sons, the answer comes. But it's not a voice that's inserted upon us, just in the same way that the way Living Wisdom School, for example, works with the children. I mean, it's when I was in that room with those kids and they were just, you know, moving out beyond my magnetism and my understanding, you know, there's a desire to try to make them behave. And that's how a lot of adults deal with children. That's how a lot of schools deal with children. What Education for Life and Living Wisdom School is to inspire them to behave, to awaken within them their own understanding of where their own best interests lie, and then to inspire them to want to do that which will bring for them a positive future. Because when our natural impulses are merely suppressed, even in the Bhagavad Gita it says, the words are, of what avail is suppression? You simply suppress it, and Swami writes it elsewhere. If you suppress something in yourself, it will just pop out in some weird way later. Suppression is not the same as understanding that my own best interests lie in this particular way of behaving. And it simply doesn't serve us to just deny ourselves that which is attractive to us. That little child said to me, but I am a child. I'm going to behave in a childlike way. That's my job right now. And we are these children of the infinite. And our job is to understand who we are, where we're going, and how to find what it is that we really seek. And Divine Mother works with us as wise parents work. Sometimes she just lets us run, and sometimes she begins to pull back. But there's also a simple reality to it. If we constantly do things that are not in our best interest, then we do not achieve anything that we really want to have. And some parents think that, oh, I can't crush my child's spirit, I can't deny his will, I can't, you know, as if they don't have a job to do. The parent has no job to do. The parent job is just the same. You have to magnetize that child's understanding step by step. You can't just abdicate and just let him run free because he or she is just a child. They don't understand yet. So Divine Mother is always guiding us. But just what she's trying to tell us, we have to try to understand what is trying to be taught to us. What's trying to be taught to us is so simple. It's so simple that the mind constantly rejects it. And that is, I am loved. I am not loved because. I am not loved because I got good at something. I'm not loved because I've earned that love. And I'm not necessarily loved by all those people out there because they don't know me. They don't really know me the way Divine Mother knows me. You know, all of us, or I hope all of us, at one time or another in our lives, have had someone who expressed to us a little bit of that divine acceptance, just so that it opens up in our consciousness the possibility that it's there. When somebody looks at you and you really feel that they really know who they're looking at, they see you. It's a funny thing. My sister came in a couple of weekends and helped with the work of helping to get this play together. And being raised by the same parents in the same house, we were talking about being siblings and talking about our brother. There are three of us. And the peculiar sort of understanding, at least that the three of us have in certain ways, we live our lives and we're not together all the time by any means. But my brother and I especially, and my sister to a certain extent, we have the same sense of humor. And I have learned through the years that my sense of humor, I think the word is weird. It's the things that I find funny, I've gradually learned a lot of people do not find funny. But when I'm with my brother, not only does he find them funny, but he gets the joke before I've even said it. You know, you just look at things and you get what's going on there. And it's a very small thing, isn't it? But in any point in life where for even just a moment we really feel that we are completely at home, completely understood, and even that which other people think odd just feels and is normal. Now, multiply that beyond a magnitude that you can even imagine. And that is our reality. You know, everything in life seems to feel like it has to be acquired, doesn't it? Oh, I have to get my retirement order. I need to get my house. I have to get my education. What is my job going to be? Where is my family? What am I going to wear? You know, just everything that we think about, we're standing here and there's always this effort involved. And if we have confidence in ourselves, if we have willpower, if we have intelligence, we can sort of move through the game. It's not necessarily that scary, the game. We just move through it and we figure it out. But still, there's always this, here I am, there it is, let me try to find it. And so it leads to what I was describing in my transition between sleep and wakefulness, this sort of underlying slight sense of anxiety. Is this really going to work out? Is some force going to come in and take me away? You know, being raised in a Jewish family and still identifying to an extent with being Jewish, I always think about somebody's going to come in and just take it all away from us. Yesterday, Gary McSweeney and I, the Irishman back there who put a sign up on his classroom, only Irish actors welcome at this point. We had an amusing, ridiculous experience yesterday, both of us. I was just talking to one of the parents I'd never met, and she says out of nowhere, "Are you Irish?" I said, "Russian Jew." Okay. Gary was at the bagel shop, and some Orthodox Jews thought he was a rabbi. Go figure, what a day for both of us. All right, now let's see, where was I going with all of that? Oh, so I was telling Gary, he'd never heard of the Eastern European Latke famine. That was such a big event, that you don't even understand. The Irish potato famine was such a big problem in Ireland, so I was talking about the Latke famine. Latkes are made from potatoes. It's a Jewish food. Well, that one went flat, didn't it? But we were just talking about all these different identities. What I was saying was about being Jewish. With that in the background, there's always the persecution that comes with it. And I think one of the reasons I was born into that cultural tradition is because I have a fear of those things. You know, anything that we're afraid of is karma that we still haven't worked out. Swami Kriyananda had a dream that he wrote to us in a letter. And he said, in the dream, he was being burned at the stake. And he said, in the way of dreams, he said he was being burned in the stake over here, and over here, some of his friends were having dinner together. And he was being burned at the stake, and they were having dinner together over here. And he was talking about the fact that he didn't have any fear or anxiety at all about being burned. He knew it would hurt. You know, it would hurt for a while, and then he would go into the astral world, and it really wouldn't make any difference. He said, honestly, that the idea of being martyred in that way or sitting down to dinner looked just the same to him. Both were just an experience. And both were something that was happening outside of himself. Because the real reality of his nature was the understanding that I am loved by God, I am always with God, that all of this that happens in this world is just a vibration, and the closer I get to center, then there is nothing except what is at the center, which is God and bliss. You know, sometimes when you have a really deep meditation, or even a medium meditation, when you're able to get into your practice of Kriya, or your practice of Hong Sa, or the Om technique, or whatever method that you use, and for a time, the door to that other reality just opens up. And you live for the period of that meditation and for some time afterwards in the simplicity of breath, of the Om vibration, of the energy in the spine, and then literally you come forward from that back into this world. And there are your emails, and there's your family, and there's all the responsibilities that you have to take care of, but they've suddenly become just a slight overlay over the true reality. This is literally a costume that we wear. And that costume isn't just the clothes that we wear. It's the body itself, the personality, and all those subconscious tensions. They're just a costume that we're wearing. They're like safety pins. They're just all put together. And when it's all taken apart, there's something completely different there. And the masters endlessly try to tell us this. Just endlessly. One after another, century after century, you know, year after year, generation after generation, and then priests and ministers and administrators and all these other people come together and try to put it into some form. So you come to church on Sunday, so this is what you have to do. Then you follow this ritual, and this clergy person will do this, and then we'll say the Sanskrit mantra, and then we'll burn this fire. And all of it is designed to just roll us back from that costume to just standing in the simple truth of who we are. And none of those external activities, which is what the mind does, this has to be complex. We have to give this teaching in a language that nobody understands anymore, because that's how originally it came down. You know, when we first took over this church, which had been St. Aloysius Catholic Church for some 40 years before it became Ananda's temple, there was a big table here for giving mass, and a big monolith in the middle, and a crucifix on it. And when we first started teaching here, at that time we wore white, and I remember standing up here the first few Sundays in white, speaking to this group in this room. I couldn't quite see them, but I could feel all these black-clad men, all these black priests in black robes back there. They were really annoyed. They were really annoyed. Their spirit was sort of back there. And finally, I just literally in meditation said, get over it. You know, it's not yours anymore. It belongs to us. You know, we've moved on. We're no longer facing the altar speaking Latin. I'm a woman, I'm in white, I'm speaking English, we're just doing it differently now. But all of it had been the same attempt. The attempt of the black-clad priest speaking Latin was in some way to move people out of all this complexity into their simple relationship with Jesus. That's all. The Jews say, "Hear, O Israel, hear, people of Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." One reality. Move away from all that complexity. All of the spiritual path comes down to that simple idea. Who am I? And when I answer that question, what does that mean for everything else? If I am, as all the scriptures and all the masters have told us, a much loved, infinitely loved, ever blissful child of God, what are the implications of that? What do I ever have to worry about? What in this world can ever take that away from me? You know, why do I steal potholders from someone else? Why do I try to steal power from someone else? Why do I try to make myself powerful by means that are pathetic by comparison to the power that I have within me? Why can't I just say, of course I behave this way. I'm just a child. Divine Mother, but you can help me. You know, my Heavenly Father, you can guide me. Just in our play last night, we were quoting the poetry of Hafiz. The story was about the Persian poet Hafiz. And at the very beginning, this very talented girl says, "Just sit there. Don't do anything. Your separation from God is the hardest job that you have. It's the hardest thing you'll ever do." I haven't quoted it exactly, but that's the meaning. We work so hard to stay separated, when in fact, all we have to do is relax, become very simple, be that child of God, and let Him, let her love us. Bless you.